We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bojovic. Joining me today is Kevin Muir, author of the Macro Tourist Newsletter and co-host of the Market Huddle. Thanks for joining me today, Kev.
Great to be with you again, Tom.
Excellent to have you as always. And there's so many different things to talk about in the macro sense right now. So I thought it'd be a good time to have you on just to kind of give us some perspective on all of these different programs and issues that need to be, you know, have some light shed on them. So why don't we start with basically an update? The last time we spoke was about three and a half, four months ago. So maybe give us an update of kind of what's been happening in, let's say, the TGA, the RRP program, what's been happening at the Fed, kind of the biggest milestones that come to mind since the last time we spoke.
Well, the TGA is the Treasury General Account, and that was it was an account that really was higher than it should have been. It was kind of an offshoot of the COVID problem. They've managed to get that down. In terms of the overnight repo program, that's a function of the excess liquidity that is in the system. And in essence, what happens is if the Fed doesn't mop up and provide a place for the excess liquidity to go, people would buy T-bills or other short-term instruments and actually send rates negative. So because there's so much in the system, they've literally flooded the entire kind of financial system with all this liquidity. They needed something to mop it up. And so they made this this overnight repo that is, in essence, almost over $1 trillion every single night. So that represents how much excess liquidity is in there. And not surprising, we've seen the Fed do, let's just say, a hawkish tilt. And one of the things at the last FOMC that we've, the recent development is that the FOMC, the Powell indicated that not only was the dots, meaning the forecast of where the FOMC presidents and members thought that rates were going to go, not only did they go up, they also introduced, in essence, a timeline for tapering, meaning the reducing the amount of bonds that they buy through the quantitative easing program. And what was surprising about that was it was remarkably firm in that he said that unless there was a dramatic change in the markets or the economy, it was going to get done. And the other surprising part about it was the timeline. A lot of people thought it would be something where they would do 15, you know, 10, they would taper 10 billion a month on the treasuries and 5 billion on the mortgage backs. Powell indicated a timing that would represent more likely that they would have to taper $20 billion each month. So it was a very dramatic shift in the Fed's attitude. We saw the Fed introduce taper. The taper was bigger than expected and quicker than expected. And not only that, the dots went up. So to me, the Fed has gone from being this very dovish tailwind at your back to all of a sudden providing a little bit of a headwind to you. And you have to ask a question is, given that the Fed's changed stance, maybe it's time to change stance of your portfolio and your what you're expecting for market returns.
Mm-hmm. That really affects the risk assets, as you were putting it, and changes your attitude towards those, right?
That's correct. So I've been bullish risk assets ever since the COVID crisis. I've been one of the few that has kind of said that the Fed and the government could fill any economic hole that we saw. And partly is that's kind of my belief that understanding how MMT works and the belief that there was a lot more room on the financial side than people expected. In the previous crisis, in the great financial crisis, we saw a situation where they thought that the problem was too much debt, and therefore the last thing the government should do in terms of a crisis is spend more. It was also coincided with this Carmen Reinhardt and Rogoff book, This Time is Different, that said that once an economy goes over 100% of its debt to GDP, there's going to be financial crisis. So last time we had a situation where the government actually withdrew spending and pulled back on the reins, and there was very little fiscal. this time, due to the nature of COVID and the change in attitude of after the last crisis, it was the exact opposite reaction. We saw a situation where the governments filled the hole. And I would argue that not only did they fill the hole, they might have filled it up and then put a little extra on it. And that little extra is what we're seeing now with all the inflation. And so for the last year and a half, I've been pretty bullish on risk assets. I've kind of steadfastly say as long as the Fed and the government is having your, you know, doing these expansionary policies, there's no reason to get bearish. Now, all of a sudden, I look and I see the Federal Reserve getting a little more hawkish. I see central banks throughout the world getting more hawkish. Poland did a surprise hike the other day, 40 basis points. We see the UK 2 years trading at 50 basis points. It's gone up 30 basis points in the last month and a bit. All over the world, we're seeing central banks getting more hawkish. So we have central banks moving against us. And more importantly than that, we have what I call fiscal fatigue. And fiscal fatigue is basically the government saying, okay, we spent all this money during the COVID crisis and we did all the stimulus, but it's time to start balancing the books. It's time to start pulling back on it. And yes, you can see a situation where you'll say, but look, you know, the Democrats are arguing about this $3.5 trillion bill. Well, that $3.5 trillion bill is over, what, 5 or 10 years? It's not that big a deal when you look at it as a percent of the GDP, the economy. It's a $21 trillion economy. And not only that, we had a situation where when Biden first came in, he just handed out $2 trillion. Just boom, handed it out. And that wasn't investments over 10 years. That was just in your genes, you know, sending money out. And so when I look at the situation that's unfolding in front of us, for the first time, I'm seeing both the fiscal side not being as conducive to risk assets. And also at the same time, the monetary side, central banks getting more hawkish. And so I'm outright bearish on the stock market now. I look at it and I think there's all sorts of risks. The market is priced for perfection. And with these two huge headwinds in front of us, I see the time to be aggressive is long past. Mm-hmm.
So I want to go back to something that you were saying about the Fed starting to taper, as well as having the reverse repo program at the same time. I spoke with Luke Groman last week, and he was saying this is kind of like, you know, withdrawing the big needle on one arm and slowly dripping the heroin in on the other side with the reverse repo program. So does it really matter that they're tapering at this point?
So I would almost argue it's like sucking and blowing at the same time. So you have a situation where the government is doing quantitative easing. And so what is quantitative easing? Quantitative easing is buying bonds from the marketplace. So they phone up JP Morgan, they ask for an offering on, you know, 20 million of whatever, and they do the trade. So on one hand, they're withdrawing securities from the marketplace, but then they have so much cash out in the system that market participants are saying, but wait, we need somewhere to invest. And they're saying, well, okay, well, we'll give you this overnight repo so that you have somewhere to go and invest. And so it's, you kind of realize that the whole idea of tapering is not very, it's time is over. And the reason it's time is over is because you have a situation where you've added so much liquidity that you actually have to start mopping it up. So I'm hesitant to use Luke's analogy, because to me, it seems like it's just balancing out the system to where it should be more. And if you're on one hand trying to, you know, add liquidity to the system, and then at the same time trying to withdraw liquidity in the system, you might just say, well, why don't you stop doing both? And I think that's the idea that they're trying to do, that hopefully at the end of the QE, when they do the taper and they pull back, they'll eventually see the reverse repo program going down. Mm-hmm. And it gets a little more complicated than that, because it's at different stage parts of the curve. So reverse repo is at the very front of the curve, and it's a cash management tool. Whereas when they're doing QE, they're actually going out and doing longer dated bonds and notes, and there's some duration there. So it is affecting kind of, how would I describe it? The various different types of risk assets there are that are out there. And so I would say that what they're going to do is they're going to allow the market to have more of the long dated risk assets, which is what they want. And then hopefully there won't be the same demand at the short end.
So how is the bond market reacting right now? You recently wrote that it is starting to sniff out a potential policy error. And you said that the yield curve is smarter than any forecaster. If right. It's flattening, we should listen to it. So can you explain that to us?
Yeah. So that was in the days, I wrote that in the days after the FOMC move. So the FOMC came, they announced their taper. They had a situation where the dots went up. And I know everyone says the dots don't matter. And I'm the first one to say the dots don't matter. And for those who don't know the dots are they ask every board member of the FOMC to present what they think interest rates will be next year, this year, next year, 2 years from now, and then long term. And they present this and then they watch for changes in the dots. And it's kind of a dumb exercise at times, but when you're looking for attitude changes amongst the FOMC members, it ends up being the best way that you can do it instead of trying to read between the lines on their speeches. So what they did was the dots went up. They seemed very hawkish. It seemed like up until this point, if you recall, the Federal Reserve had been very insistent that we were going to have what they called flexible average inflation targeting. And what that was the idea that instead of the moment that inflation goes up to 2%, you raise rates, they're going to say, well, you know, we had a year of 0 or 1% inflation. So therefore, we can have a year of 3 or 4. And it was, in essence, to make it up so that you average 2% as opposed to the 2% being a ceiling when you change your policy. And this was a dramatic change at the Federal Reserve, and it seemed like it was a new Federal Reserve, the new, nicer Federal Reserve. And it's part of the reason that you saw stock market take off and you saw commodities take off. This was indicating that the Federal Reserve was going to be looser for longer. Now, what happened is they called it flexible average inflation targeting, and the key is that first word, flexible. They never defined where they were going to go and how much inflation they were going to allow before they started to go and hike rates. And it was always a little bit of a guessing game. So was the Fed going to be comfortable with 4% for a year or 5%? And what's in, and that was why we got in these big debates about whether it was inflation was transitory or not. So it was kind of confusing. And so the market's always looking, trying to figure out, at what point is the Federal Reserve nervous of inflation? When are they going to change their policy? How much are they going to allow? And for the longest time, they kept saying inflation is transitory, inflation is transitory. And they kept just repeating this. And that's why the market was a little bit caught off guard at this last FOMC meeting, because for the first time, they seemed to be saying, no, we're actually nervous about inflation. Oh, and we're going to taper quicker than we expected. And our dots are higher. So the market went and said, oh my goodness, look at this. This Fed is more like the Fed of old. And so what you saw was a dramatic flattening of the yield curve. And what that means is that the short end went up faster than the long end. And when I said that comment about that the yield curve is the best market signal out there, I completely agree with you that it is. And what the bond market was telling you at that point was that they thought the Fed was being too tight. And that is part of the reason that we're actually seeing risk assets struggle. And it's all one and the same. It's almost like the market giving you a voting on whether how loose or tight the Fed's policies are. And that's how you should think about the yield curve. And since then, we've actually seen the stock market wobble a little. We've started to see some other things. And what's happened, though, is that we've had a combination of two different things that have occurred since that period, which was what the FOMC was last month, maybe it was 3 or 4 weeks ago. Since then, we've seen inflation break-evens explode higher. And that's been a function of basically oil taking off and energy going through the roof. So there's been more inflation. And then all of a sudden, as we said, that the stock market is getting a little more wobbly. So I think that the yield curve is starting to steepen again. And the reason it's steepening again is because they're almost worried about a potential policy error, meaning that as we get central banks going and raising rates, as we get the Fed tapering, we might have a sell-off in risk assets. And then if they do that, then we're back to the same old, you know, the Fed's going to go and lower rates. So it's kind of a complicated, difficult thing to look at it because there's all sorts of nuances about at what time frame are you looking at. If you kind of step back and look at it over a longer time frame, 6 months ago, when the Fed was in the middle of their flexible average inflation target, I have 5.30s, which is the kind of the yield curve that everyone looks at, was almost at its highs, almost at its widest. And at that point, the stock market and the bond market was convinced the Fed was going to be looser for longer. And now we see that the 5.30s have collapsed. And yes, they're up in the last couple of weeks, but the reality is it's not that much. And the curve is way flatter. And the reason the curve is way flatter is because the stock market and the bond market are convinced that the Fed is not going to let rates go they're not going to let inflation go as long as that they had previously worried. And so ultimately, this is kind of this tug of war between the Fed will tighten until something breaks, and then they will see a situation where they'll loosen again. The question is, where does it break? I think it's going to break sooner than most people believe, but that's me.
So we're almost in a waiting game in a holding pattern until we see something break at this point, right?
That's right. And the other problem about this is that the Fed is in a very difficult spot because inflation is not being solely driven by demand increases. A lot of the inflation issues are actually the supply side of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting to think about what's happened since we've had the vaccines and the emergence of Delta. If you think back to the spring, we thought that we were going to get a situation where everyone was going to get vaccinated. We were going to lick this COVID. Life's going to be back to normal. We had the talk about the vaccine waxed. Is that what the kids said? I think it was vaccine waxed summer. It was going to be, life was going to return to normal. And then unfortunately we had Delta, and Delta came and, you know, just putting aside all the politics and everything about it, it wasn't what the market expected. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being that you have situations where businesses aren't back to normal like we thought they were going to be. We have situations where, kids are getting sick and at home, and it ends up being a huge supply shock. You just have to think, even just like the kids getting sick, even if nobody's dying, we're just getting kids sitting, you know, getting sick at home. It means that someone's at home with them for 2 weeks, not working. And that's more of a supply shock. And we were already suffering from a supply shock. And the real question is the Fed's raising rates, what are they going to do about that? They can't fix that inflation. They can't fix the number of boats that are sitting off of the coast in LA waiting to be, you know, unbarked and unloaded. And I think that they're in a tough spot because they're sitting there watching inflation go up, and they're going to be most likely raising and getting hawkish into an economy that is weak because of the supply shock. And that's why I'm really nervous about risk assets up here, because they're in a no-win situation. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to just remember that the Fed is not going to fix things by raising rates, and it's not like these inflation problems are going away. They're not. Mm-hmm.
So as we think about inflation, Kevin, I appreciate getting to speak to you because you have such a good perspective on all these different mechanisms. So how does the euro dollar market affect the inflation picture? How much does it matter? And could it be causing inflation to roll over and possibly ease more than we think it could?
So by euro dollars, I'm assuming you're meaning the short-term funding markets in US dollars that are denominated in US dollars that are overseas. Mm-hmm. So I know many of the kind of the strategists and the kind of gurus out there will talk all about how these inflation is a function of how much the Fed printed and all of these things. And you'll hear all these mechanisms that talk about, you know, this is the problem with having such the world's biggest QE. I don't believe QE causes inflation. And I don't believe those things matter as much as they say they do. And I think I told you last time we'll do it again. Like when Federal Reserve buys some bonds from JP Morgan, they go and they, you know, credit JP Morgan with all this cash. And this cash, in theory, is available to be lent out, but in reality, JP Morgan has already made all the loans they want to make, and they're not reserve constrained. What they are constrained is by their own balance sheet and the willingness of borrowers to borrow. So they're not the Federal Reserve doing those things in the funding market and changing the euro dollar rate isn't affecting anything more than the financial economy. And I think that this is the problem, is that too many people assume that what happens in the financial economy affects what happens in the real economy. And I think that there are two distinct and different kind of segments. And I have no doubt that what the Federal Reserve does in terms of QE, their tapering, it affects stock prices. It affects the prices of the euro dollar curve and how it's going to play out. And I don't deny that in the least. And as a trader that trades all these things, I sit around staring at them as well. And I'm trying to play the game of figuring out where the Fed's, you know, when are they going to break it? How much are they going to do? But in terms of the real economy, I think it's very limited. And the euro dollar problems are actually problems the other way. We have too much liquidity right now. And so there were some people that one point talked about the overnight repos causing a risk off event. And the reason it's really complicated, but the reason that they thought that was because the overnight repos got charged a different capital amount as opposed to regular owning like other loans and other things that the banks could do with it. So there was a period, and it was for a couple months when the overnight repo went up, that you would see risk off events and you would see it was actually correlated. And there was a relationship there, but my understanding is that they fixed a lot of those issues, and it's very difficult for that relationship to be at all explanatory of in terms of risk assets. And so I think, though, if I was to say one thing, I would say just when you hear people talk about QE and then you realize, like, back to my sucking and blowing at the same time, yeah, they're buying all these bonds and it sounds so scary, but at the same time, they're withdrawing liquidity on the other side. So yes, you know, it's difficult to say it's affecting it exactly this way. And I would just be wary of anyone that says, I know exactly how this is affecting this or that, because the reality is we've never done this before. We've never had the Federal Reserve doing all these things. So we're all learning all these different things. But I will say that a lot of these things that are people are focused on them and they're convinced that they're affecting the real economy, they're affecting the real economy way less than they think. Mm-hmm.
So if QE is not as inflationary as people think it is, what do you think of as the true source of inflation right now?
So the true source of inflation, there's two ways that you can make inflation. And the one way is there's two ways you can make money. And then generally money creates inflation. If you have more money than that you're chasing fewer goods, then you'll have inflation. So the two ways that you can create money are: one is for commercial banks to lend it into existence. And that is the traditional way that we have had thought about it for the past 40 years. And ever since Volcker tamed the back of inflation by raising rates way up and altering the cost of money to change the behavior of individuals and corporations to the private sector to borrow or lend, they've used that as their tool on how to actually control the economy. So what we saw was they raised rates. He actually broke the back of inflation, which nobody thought he could do. But ever since then, every single time the economy gets into trouble, they lower rates. And what are they doing when they're lowering rates? they are in essence trying to, you know, entice borrowers to go out and borrow more money and create economic activity. And as we've gotten more and more borrowers, we've gotten to the point where it's become, it's taken ever and lower rates to encourage them to actually spend. To the finally, we got into a situation, the great financial crisis, where we put it to zero. And even at zero, it wasn't enough. And then they had to do quantitative easing. They had to try all these different, you know, extraordinary measures. At the time, everyone thought that would create inflation. Everyone believed that those were going to, you know, set off this hyperinflationary loop. You know, I've talked about it before, the open letter to Ben Bernanke about how QE2, I think it was going to cause this, you know, hyperinflationary thing that he couldn't control. But the reality is we got no inflation. We actually got the worst economic recovery in, you know, in decades. And we didn't have any of the problems that they all thought we were going to have. And the reason was because at that point, monetary policy had become utterly impotent. Like they just, it was neutered. And the reality is that we think it does stuff, but it really doesn't. And so then, I mentioned there's two ways you can create money. One is for the private sector to lend money into existence. Well, the second way is for the government to spend it into existence. And if you think about it, the government goes and when they spend, it's a deficit, but everybody's deficit, there must be someone else's credit. And whose credit is it? And it's all of ours. So when they spend, they put that money into existence and it can eventually create inflation. And this has always been what the MMTers will talk about. They'll talk about the fact that governments are never financially constrained, because the old idea was that if you hit a certain level, the government couldn't go and spend anymore. There would be a financial crisis. And yet, when you look at it, Japan is at 250% debt to GDP, and they've had no financial crisis. And so this was the old thinking, and it was tossed out the window during COVID. And I think it was proven pretty clearly that the government can spend whatever it wants, and it's not going to have a financial crisis on that way, provided that they're a currency issuer. No, there's a few rules that they have to do, but most of us, most developed nations are able to do this. And then you might say to yourself, well, if that's the case, like, that's crazy. That just, like, they can't just spend, you know, there's got to be limits. And the limit is inflation. And that's always the point. And, you know, if you think about the discussions that we were having post-COVID, they were dramatically different than the discussions we were having post-Great Financial Crisis. Like, even Larry Summers, who crapped all over MMT and is kind of a surly guy, and he wasn't very nice to MMT, but if you think about it, he was still arguing about how much inflation would be created. And that was the point, is that the dialogue had changed. It had changed from a dialogue about, are we going to have a financial crisis, to, are we doing too much fiscal for the amount that we need, and are we going to create inflation? And listen, I'm sympathetic to the idea that we did too much. I think we did too much too quick. And I realize it was an emergency. It was kind of almost like a war situation, and it was difficult to get it to the right people. So you might as well just shotgun it out there and give it to everybody so that you make sure that the people are safe. But now I look at it and they gave out $2 trillion the moment that Biden got into office, like that first bill that he fired out. It was $2 trillion that just went into everyone's jeans. And now we're sitting around and we're arguing about this $1.5 to $2.5 trillion bill, but this is over 10 years. And this is my point, that we've gone from just handing out money and to any, like, to for this crisis. And now we're getting religion about this. And not only that, we were prepared to give away all this money, but we weren't prepared to invest. Like, to me, the infrastructure bill should be way, way bigger. It's like $1 trillion or something. I don't know the numbers. It's so hard to remember, but it's like, we're talking a $21 trillion economy, and it's like $1 trillion over the 5 or 10 years. It's nothing. We should be doing that every year and investing in our economy. And one of the things that I'm not very much of a Paul Krugman fan. One of the reasons I'm not a Paul Krugman fan is because he doesn't seem to believe in the broken window fallacy. And I broken window fallacy is the idea that if you break a window and then you someone has to fix it, you've created GDP. And I go, yeah, but it's not very efficient. It's not like you like, it's like he, at one point, I think Krugman said, well, if you were better off digging ditches and then not paying someone else to fill them up. And I said, yeah, you know, you're right. Like I get what he was arguing, but the reality is that over the long run, we're all poorer for that. Like just like the broken window fallacy, we're going to be poorer for that. That money that was spent doing the repair on the window could have been spent or it's not used money. Those resources that were spent using the repair on the window could have been spent doing something else, could have been spent building someone a new home or doing something productive. And this is one of my complaints is that when I look at what the decisions we're making as a society, we were all prepared to hand out money all the time before when in the midst of the crisis. And now that the crisis is gone, we're not doing the infrastructure investment that we should be doing. And this is kind of one of my issues. But anyways, I can't remember your question, but let's just take it back to inflation. Oh, I remember what it was. What causes inflation? Inflation in this environment is caused by the government crowding out private resources by spending too much. And there's more to it than that. There's also the supply side that we were talking about earlier. But on the whole, most of it is caused by the government crowding out. And so the real question is, what is the appropriate fiscal stance to create the proper amount of inflation? And ultimately, you know, I believe that maybe not this quarter or this year, but ultimately we will, as a society, start choosing a stance that is much more inflationary.
So to kind of go back to one of the other, like, let's say, adding to the risks of the risk on assets right now, you recently wrote an article entitled "The Risk Few Are Talking About." And in it, you discuss how the SEC's new chair, Gary Gensler, is sending a clear signal to the markets that is being ignored. So what is that signal and what are some of the examples of the behavior he is targeting?
So Gary Gensler recently... I guess he posed or he was a featured piece on Bloomberg or Business Week. And he says the coming crackdown on everything. And that's what those were his words, the coming crackdown of everything. And when you look at the message that he was sending you through this piece and what he was talking about, he looks at the environment that we have experienced over the last couple of years in financial markets. And he rightfully recognizes that there are a lot of abuses and a lot of excesses there that are not being properly dealt with. I've been in the markets since the early 90s. I can tell you that I have been absolutely floored by the things that people have done in terms of promoting stuff on YouTube, the stuff in terms of the SPACs with these promoters. It just seems to me like it's this Wild West. I compared it actually to the party at Animal House, that movie. It feels like it's been just mind-blowing for me. And not only that, I think that it can all be summed up with... there's one poster child that displays this almost perfectly, and that's Elon Musk and Tesla. Like, if you think back to, he got, I don't know what he was doing. He was most likely in the sauce or doing something else, and he went and said 420 bid funding secured one day as a joke, and this one the stock was trading at 320 or whatever, meaning that he was joking about a takeover on his stock. And the question is, you know, when you or I joke about that, that's one thing. But when the CEO of somebody jokes, like of a company jokes about that, like, is it true? Like, is there bids? Whatever it is.
And publicly, though, nonetheless.
Yeah. And so he sent this stock up. And I actually thought at that point, this is it. It's over. Like, he's just ruined his whole career. He's ruined his whole, like, this stock. It'll never be able to go up again. And the reason I thought that was because, you know, yes, I get it that the Wall Street Bet guys and the Reddit folks, they love him. He's great. And like, and as I joked, I said, I was young once too. Like, I get it. Sticking it to the man. He's great and stuff like that. But if you're sitting there as a fiduciary and you're managing billions of dollars and you have to explain your investments, it's increasingly difficult after seeing a CEO behave with such erratic behavior to say, oh no, this is a great idea. Like this guy's really got it going. Like, it's very clear at this point that the guy is just a loose cannon in this erratic behavior. And so I thought that that was it. I thought the stock was done at this point, and I was wrong, like spectacularly, because the stock's proceeded to explode since then. And all the guys that, it did go down. First of all, by the way, it did. I was right. I was right for 6 months. It did go down from 420 to 200 or whatever, and a 50% drawdown. But then all of a sudden it ended up being that he got a little bit of a fine and nothing really happened. Like, nothing really happened. He went onto ABC News and said that he doesn't respect the SEC. And then it got even worse. And in the kind of early days of after COVID, when, if you remember back then, the market was starting to perk up, but there still wasn't the huge amount of shenanigans going on. It was just the start of this bull market. He got on there and he tweeted out that, I don't know how to say this. Well, just go Google the Wheel of Fortune and Elon Musk. You'll see it. Like, everyone knows what he did. Okay. So he does this stunt and you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, like, look what he just told the SEC to do. This guy's done, right? Nothing happened to him. And I think at that point, the markets and other market participants realized that the SEC was not serious on cracking down on anything. And from then you got the crazy guy that they made an electric truck, and then they told everyone that it was a working model prototype, and they rolled it down the hill. The other day the Coinbase guy accused this SEC of being really sketchy. You have Chamath pumping things on TV. It's just, and don't even start me on the crypto, the amount of like stuff that goes on there. It's just being like a free for all. Like, there's literally the party is like people hanging from chandeliers off the ceiling. Like, this is being the wildest orgy of speculation that I've ever seen. Like, even GameStop, AMC, all these things are just crazy, crazy stuff. And yes, you might say that there was all sorts of badness that was going on with hedge funds shorting too much GameStop. I'm not going to sit here and defend their behavior, but I can tell you that on the other side, there is just as much, not illicit, I would just say aggressive behavior the other way. And that ultimately, some people are going to get really hurt by this. And the longer it goes on, the worse it's going to be. And that is the only thing I'm sure of. The longer it goes on, the worse it'll be. Now, so we get this new SEC chairman, and it's Gary Gensler, and he's been in there, I don't know, 3-6 months. He's not going to go and just change things overnight because he's got to figure out the lay of the land. He's been, getting up to speed and things like that. But now he sent a very, very clear message. And this message was in this article, and it was geared, it was in a financial publication, it was Bloomberg. He was sending you a very clear message. I have the privilege of knowing this great trader named Jim Leitner, and he calls it listening to the game master. And I think that the market is not listening to the fact that he is about to change the rules. He is about to clamp down on things. And when I think about, like, I told you all the reasons I was bearish, and the monetary side of it is tight. The fiscal side with the fiscal fatigue is tight. And now on the regulatory side, this is just like the icing on the cake to me. We have tightness coming from there. And lest you think that it's not something that's going to happen quickly, when Gary Gensler gave this interview, he said he likened it to the Martin Luther King speech, where he says the fierce urgency of now. I don't know that speech by Dr. King, so I went and looked it up, and I quoted it. Like, all I can say is that this Gensler is giving you a very clear message that this is coming, and this is coming quickly. And I think that investors should pay attention. And then you might say, well, I'm invested in blah, 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 and that they're not doing anything illegal. I completely agree. Like, a lot of these things will be geared towards individual companies, individuals doing certain things. But having said that, you know, when they go and tighten regulations, they usually go from one boat to the other boat side of the boat too far. So I doubt the market's going to take it well, even though in the long run, I think it's a very necessary and kind of long overdue development, but I doubt the market will be, you know, take it well. And the other thing is, if you are in some of these crazy, highly speculative names, I would say that you should think long and hard about whether you want to be on the other side of the government when they start cracking down on this.
Yeah, that's a great point, Kevin. And as we talk about, you know, increasing regulation, we recently saw Elizabeth Warren express her thoughts about Jerome Powell being a dangerous man to head up the Fed because of his actions deregulating Wall Street. So two Fed chairs have recently resigned over the scandal of their trading positions. But you wrote that this puts Powell's renomination in jeopardy. So why is that?
So I think he's done. Like I think he's 100% done. Well, not 100. Good trader never says never. But I think the chances of him surviving are low. And the reason is when Elizabeth Warren goes out of her way to do this to publicly attack him. Mm-hmm. Okay, for him to survive, you're going to have to get somebody to expend political capital the other way, meaning someone's going to have to go out and get in a fight with Elizabeth Warren about this and say, no, he's our guy and we want to. And I think about it and I think, like, I personally believe that Powell is a decent man that was trying to do what he thought best. I really do. I'm, you know, he's had his missteps, his long way from neutral, you know, was a comment was terrible. But we're all human. We all have bad, you know, things that we do. But I think he's a decent man. I think Elizabeth Warren is way out of line doing this. Having said that, I believe it was a political move that she wants somebody more hawkish on the regulation side in terms of the banks. She's still after the banks. I think she's fighting the last war, by the way, because I don't think the banks are the problem here. That, like, in if anything, I think the banks are the problem because they're not giving enough loans out. We're not getting enough private sector credit creation. So, you know, as a typical regulator slash politician, they're fighting the last war. But back to why he's done, you'd have to go out of your way to protect them. And then I just look at it and I say, okay, he's not even a Democrat. He's put in by Trump. So why would you go out of your way to save political, like spend political capital to protect this guy? And not only that, although I think he's a decent human being, I think the two jokers that did all the trading, I think they should get everything that's coming to them. I think it's pathetic that they were worth the kind of money that they did and yet still felt that they had to trade to make more. I think it's exceptionally greedy. It's everything that's wrong. I think that they should hang them up. I think that at the same time, Elizabeth Warren should go after the members of Congress that are trading. Like, that to me is... it's just mind-boggling that somehow it's illegal for Wall Street traders to do this, yet it's completely fine for Congress to do, and they're setting the rules. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's hypocrisy at its best. But the long and short of it is that they're going to get his two lieutenants did something really terrible. I think they damaged the Fed's reputation and they're standing tremendously. I don't think you can I don't think people understand in the long-term damage that was done by those two jokers. And I think that you basically have to get rid of Powell just because it happened on his watch. So I don't know what it means though. Like, that's the other thing, is I'm not sure it really means anything, except that chances are we're going to get a more dovish Federal Reserve chair ultimately. Oh, I know what I did say though. If anything, everyone assumes that that means you get a more dovish Federal Reserve chair. I think over the short run, it means that Powell is placed things closer to home, meaning that if you were Powell and you were sitting there previously trying to institute new rules for flexible average inflation targeting that were groundbreaking and changing, you might say, oh God, you know what? I'm just gonna play it by the book. Like, I'm not gonna do anything. So ironically, even though the market was interpreting Powell's getting in trouble to mean that we might get more dovish Federal Reserve, I would say that over the short run, over the long run, we're going to get a more dovish Federal Reserve. Over the short run, I actually think that that means that the old Fed, they will use the old rule book. And in fact, it'll be part of them being more hawkish than the market expects.
Just continue with his, I believe it was automated taper, some people called it.
Yes. And it is on automatic taper. Like it's going to be, they're going to set it up this November. This next FOMC meeting, and it will take a lot to get them off of that. They should. Going back to the RRP, like when you have that going on, until that's gone, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't pull back on the taper.
Mm-hmm. So as we've seen these kind of bombshells that turned out to be in some ways nothing burgers, unfortunately. How do you think the Evergrande drama is over, and what considerations do you think that, you know, one can draw from that, or conclusions one can draw from that situation?
So do I think that the Evergrande, is it Evergrande or Evergrande? I never know.
Me neither.
Do I think it's over? I think it's over in that the market was worried it was going to be a Lehman event. Mm-hmm. And I actually at the time counseled that it wasn't going to be a Lehman event. And the reason why is because we have a free market. Our market in Canada here, but in the States there, it's a free market. And when we had a situation where banks started to get in trouble, we couldn't get a situation like even when the Federal Reserve wanted to help them, wanted to save them, they couldn't save them. There weren't the mechanisms to which they could be saved. Like Lehman Brothers, you had the Federal Reserve working all weekend trying to save them from going bankrupt. They couldn't do it. And the reason is because we have a free market and the market is setting the prices and setting the rules, and we can't just change the rules willy-nilly like that. China's different. China, like President Xi says, you know, you lend to Evergrande, it's over. Like it literally is done. Like he fixes things immediately. So the point is not that, do I think Evergrande's a great investment? No. Do I think real estate could go lower in China? For sure. It could very well go lower. Will it morph into a contagion that spreads into other parts of China? No. And that is the part that everybody missed, or a lot of people missed, is that they can contain it way better than we can contain it. And it's just a function of theirs not really being a real free market. And so I think that China is going to continue trying to weed out the excesses in their system. You saw it with what? They started with tech stocks 6 months ago. They went to the education stocks, they went to real estate, they've gone by and they've been basically picking off a lot of the things that they think were excess, like, you know, you almost didn't want to be a billionaire in China because you knew President Xi was coming after you. You know, Jacques Ma, he kind of had to disappear from view. There's been other people that have completely disappeared. They're going through a transformation. They're changing the way that their economy and their society looks. You go look at President Xi. He talks about common prosperity, and you just have to look at a word count, how much he's used those words over the last 10 years. And over the last year, they've gone through the roof. Like it's every single speech, common prosperity. And even though we sit here in horror at what's happening there and think, oh my God, look at this, you know, Alibaba has gotten, you know, it's a third the price and all these terrible things have happened, the average Chinese person doesn't see it the same way. And in fact, a lot of those things that that they've done are welcome by the average Chinese. And then in terms of, you know, what are they trying to accomplish, and are there any opportunities there? I think that they were trying to do a shift, as I said, like in essence, a redistribution of wealth, take money away from a lot of the kind of individuals that have made too much and redistribute it. And I'm not as worried about China as everybody else is. I think that the moment that they want to get it going again, they will. And yes, their real estate is probably more of a mess than we think, and they probably have over-allocated to it. But I think that they're going to take away from all the excesses that were made by the real estate developers, and they're going to rejigger it and go forward. So I don't know. I feel like that you have to be careful with China. I mean, assuming that they're like us and that this is going to slip into a contagion. I just didn't think it was going to happen then, and I don't think it'll happen going forward. And in fact, if you were really gutsy, the tech stocks have been, they're so cheap. And you might give it a shot on the long side if you were a trader. They're looking better. They're starting to behave better. And yeah, I get it. You don't know what you own and you're always at the mercy of Xi. I completely get it. And if you're a long-term investor, I would understand completely why you would never touch it. Like if you would say, no, I don't know what I'm going to own, stuff like that. But if you're a trader, heck, it looks pretty good. And the only thing I'll tell you is in terms of timing is that they have this plenum where it's kind of like their election / meeting. And I'm not exactly sure, but there's one in 2022. And if you think about it, President Xi needs to get reelected or at least to get affirmed again. He's going to want the economy going by then. And if you think about what time, what is the timeline in terms of getting an economy? You don't start stimulus a month before you want to get the economy going. You get started 6 months before. Mm-hmm. So I could see a situation where we get they actually stop clamping down and they start easing up a little bit on things. And we get a situation where the Chinese economy starts to hum and come this winter / early spring. And don't forget, it's the Winter Olympics as well. They don't want a lot of, anything bad happening to their economy at that time. So if you're looking for the next big problem, I think you should look elsewhere than China. China was in the headline, was in the news, but it's probably going to seep to the back burner.
So in that vein, Kevin, where do you think the biggest risks right now lie?
So I think that the biggest risk lie in the unprofitable tech stocks. Goldman Sachs has this great index called the non-profitable tech index. And if you look at how much it's risen since the March COVID lows, I think the stock market in general, last time I looked, was up almost 100%. Like the S&P 500 was up 100% from that level. The top eight technology stocks that I'll talk to about in a second were up 150% or 140%, something like that. And then this Goldman Sachs non-profitable tech index was up like 275%.
Wow.
And to me, that reeks of having too much speculation. It reeks of having, it worries me that we're going to see Gary Gensler coming down on a lot of those type of those promotes and those issues. And I look at it in with the price appreciation, I think to myself, this is where the real risks lie. Like this thing could get halved and without even blinking. And I think the market is not appreciating that. Now, if you don't want to look there, another thing to worry about or think about is the fact that we have a situation where the top eight stocks in the S&P 500 are all tech stocks. And not only are they all tech stocks, but that top eight stocks represent over 25% of the index. And if it hasn't, we haven't been to this level of concentration at the top since the Nifty 50s. It's been decades since we've had this much. And I wrote this piece that I kind of liked. It was about Scott McNeely. Scott McNeely, for those who don't know, was the CEO of Sun Microsystems. And Tom, you're a young guy, so you won't know about Sun Microsystems. But Sun Microsystems was a Unix maker. And in the 90s, it was actually the one that powered the internet. And it was one of the go-to stocks. And Scott McNeely has this thing, the speech that he gave after the dot-com crash and when everyone was looking around wondering what went wrong. And it's, and he said, you know, what were you guys thinking? You were trading, we traded at 10 times sales. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, for you to make money for me trading at 10 times sales, like I have to give you all my money back for the next 10 years, all my sales. And I, that assumes I have no cost of employees. I have no insurance. I have no blah, blah, blah. He goes through all these things. He says, what were you guys thinking? Like having me trade at 10 times sales. And so just for a lark, I thought, oh, you know what? I'll go have a look and see what the market's trading at now. So I went and looked. The S&P 500 is actually at 3.15 times sales. This is the highest it's ever been, in term, at least in the since I had data for the last half a century. But what's more interesting is the fact that those top eight stocks, those top 10, those top tech stocks that I mentioned, I made a little index and I figured out what they were trading at, and they're trading at almost 12 times sales. And yeah, I get it. They're very profitable companies. That a lot of the companies in the .com were different. They weren't making any money. I completely get it. You can't make the immediate comparison. Having said that, I just look at it and I think to myself, this is just asking for trouble, and the valuation is very stretched. And so when I look at the risks that people are taking, one of the things that worries me is that they own too much S&P 500, which is also a U.S. index. And I think people are overweight U.S. because it's been the best performing index for the past two decades, and everyone's overweight it. And not only that, it's very concentrated in tech and these top names. So if you have to own U.S. equities, I would say you should look at buying an equal weight index. One of the things I always say is if you look over time, the equal weights outperform the market cap weights, because you're not getting a situation where you're buying those top heavy names and you're buying the lower ones. The reason that you don't find big institutions buying equal weight is because they are constrained by size. You can't, it ends up being, you can't do it because you're too large. But for regular retail investors, they should look at it. And over time, that trade has worked, and I believe it will continue to work, and I think it'll work really well. And then the other thing is that you should look at small cap stocks, and especially small cap value. When you go do studies over the last century and you look at how much value has outperformed growth, and then and when you look at how small cap has outperformed large cap, it's shocking how much better it has. And then when you combine it with the fact that this past decade, it's been the exact opposite. It's been the worst performing value has gotten crushed versus growth, and large cap has won. So to me, if you're thinking from a long-term perspective and you're trying to allocate capital, you know, the goal of the game is not to buy high, it's to buy low. And I think that by, you know, you sell high. So I think you sell those large cap growth tech stocks and you try to buy some small cap value stocks.
Excellent, Kevin. Well, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap up there. Is there anything else you'd like to add to our listeners before we do conclude?
Well, can I ask you, Tom, where are you located?
I'm in Western Canada, in Alberta.
You're in Alberta. Okay. So we didn't talk about energy, did we?
No, I just finished an entire hour on the energy cliff that Steve St. Angelo that he sees coming. So it would be interesting to see your perspective on energy.
So
as well.
He sees the energy. So I'm actually shocked that anybody is surprised that we have higher energy prices. Mm-hmm. The reality is that we have purposely gone through ESG mandates and also government policies. We've purposely starved the energy industry of capital. And now that we have a situation where we have starved them of capital, they haven't been able to replace the reserves. And now we're surprised because we still have the same demand. Mm-hmm. So if you pull away on supply and leave demand unchanged, you'll obviously get higher price. I think the market is missing the fact that China is about to grow in terms of the energy use per capita is about to explode. And so I think it's lining up to be one of the greatest trades out there. A lot of people compare it to, I saw that recently people were comparing Facebook to tobacco stocks, and that Facebook was supposedly had all all this information about how bad it was for the people, and they were hiding it. I actually like to compare the energy companies to tobacco stocks, and that in tobacco stocks were unloved. Nobody could invest in them. And yet when you looked at their returns during the 90s and 2000 up until now, they've been one of the greatest performers that it's ever been. And when I talked about the fact of owning value, a big part of that, I think, is you should think long and hard about energy, because I think it's a great something to own. And they're going to trade cheap, and they're going to continue to trade cheap, because I don't think that you're going to get the big institutions moving over. Like, they can't buy it and there won't be it. But for those that are looking for a fixed income replacement, I think you're going to see these companies buying back their shares and issuing dividends, and they're going to be the high yielders of our day. And I think that hopefully we see good times in Calgary, and you guys go back to leading the way with all your the great energy and the great part of Canada. Just stop winning hockey.
for those of us that don't necessarily care about hockey, that's okay. I'm not going to worry about stop winning hockey, but it reminds me of a bumper sticker I see all the time, is give me one more oil boom and I promise I won't waste it this time. Right.
Okay. Well, that's a good line. I like that. I'm stealing that, Tom.
Okay. Well, I want to go back to something you were saying, Kevin. Why do you say that energy use per capita in China is about to explode? One would think that it would kind of grow at a fairly steady rate as they, you know, bring more people into urban centers.
Okay. So if you look through history at the energy use per capita as societies have gotten wealthier, what you'll see is a hockey stick formation, meaning that at the beginning, it just rises a little bit as they get wealthier and wealthier. Then they hit a level where all of a sudden everyone can afford a car. Not everyone, but a lot of more people can afford a car. They're getting air conditioners, they're getting all these different things. So what you need a certain level of GDP per capita to hit that real growth part. And so if you go through history and you look, you see Japan after World War II, it happened there. You'll see the hockey stick. And then you go look in the Korea in the 70s and the 80s, it happened there. And I think that when you look at China, we are just at the stage at the bottom of the where the shaft's starting. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to explode. I think we're going to be shocked. And then the other thing is that when you look at how many people are in China, it's just huge. And listen, they're working hard on electric vehicles because they have to. Because the reality is that they import most of their oil, and they're going to be in trouble, and they realize it, and they have a real problem. And we just saw, like, how's this for a signal when the president, or not President Xi, but he gave orders. He said, from Beijing, they said to all the different states or provinces or whatever they are, they said something to the effect of secure energy supplies at whatever cost you can. And that's part of the reason we've had this little bit of a run over the last couple of weeks, is because China looked at what's happening in the UK and, you know, how their energy programs, I mean, their energy prices are going exploding higher. And they said, just get it in and just make sure you, it's more important that you have the supply than the price of it. And I think it's scary because we've gone and gotten rid of the supply based upon our desire to move to green energy. But we've done this, we've abandoned old fossil fuels before we've had the infrastructure for the new part of it. Mm-hmm. So we've just said, okay, well, we can't, you know, we don't want to do any of the old stuff, but we haven't bothered to get the new stuff ready. And it's going to be a real problem. And, you know, I'm nervous about what this is going to mean for the markets going forward. If we get a situation where oil spikes and it's $100, $150, like I've been saying for the past year that we're going to see $100 oil, and everyone used to laugh at me, and it's not that far off now, like that we're going to see $100 this year. I don't know if I'm going to make it, but I they used to laugh, and I could see a situation where it gets really dumb. And I was doing a little bit of an experiment the other day. I was taking my oil price, and I was I put it into constant dollars, meaning that I discounted it by inflation, because I was trying to get a feel for like how big is this rally, because Because one of my problems is that I've been pretty bullish on oil for a while. So I have a lot of oil and I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, I see zero hedge and everyone talking about it, and it scares me because inevitably when you get a situation where it's everyone's talking about it, you're like, oh, it's already in the price. So I thought to myself, well, I should look and see how much it's up in terms of when I discount it for with inflation. And I was shocked. We're nowhere near like this in constant, like if you put it in $1990 or something like that, we're still cheap. It's still cheap. And that's the thing I think people are not appreciating, is that we could see a situation where oil goes to $200. Like, and it wouldn't surprise me, because it's one of those things that you need. And then the real question is, we think the Fed's in a bind now. Wait till oil is screaming like that. Mm-hmm. And so what's the Fed going to do? The Fed's either got a situation where the inflation's going to be running 6-7%. And yet if they raise rates, everyone's going to have their houses and everything, like the economy is going to feel the pain. So it's a really scary situation from that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's something that there's few people that really understand how many or how much that input goes into every single cost of everything else, right? The shipping, you know, we think we have a problem with shipping now. Wait till not just containers have tripled in price or quadrupled in price. Wait till oil doubles in price, right? There's so many, you know.
And name something and think about how much energy was needed to do this. Like, and I think the other part of this thing, we haven't talked that much about inflation, about owning bonds, but I think bonds are a disaster waiting to happen, because I think we're about to have persistent inflation for many years/decades to come, and that you're going to get absolutely destroyed in bonds. And if you think about the dividend that we as a society have experienced due to cheap energy over the last, you know, especially last decade with the shale revolution, it's been, energy has been super cheap. It's been abundant. It's been easy. It's made our productivity huge. All of a sudden, if you purposely go to green energy and, you know, put aside the politics, whether we need to or whatever, it doesn't matter. We're doing it. If you just think about what that entails, that is in essence us being less productive, because we're paying more for all those things. And you could say it's a cost that we need to do because it's an existential threat, whatever. It doesn't really matter. What does matter, though, is that is going to make us way less productive. It's going to mean more inflation. And I think that people do not understand that. And to your point, you're absolutely correct. The price of energy is embedded in everything you buy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you think about the usable lifespan for a lot of these solar panels, windmills, stuff like that, we still haven't really solved the storage problem for all of that.
Oh yeah.
Steve was telling me that we need something like the US alone is going to need to consume 2,100% more cobalt than is produced right now.
Yeah.
Then the world, it's astronomical, the numbers that we're going to need to be able to transition to this green energy side of things. And while I completely agree with you, there's obviously change that is necessary. We need to be able to look at our carbon footprint and understand from an objective standpoint of what this is doing to the environment. While we do need to understand that, it's also a matter of really taking a hard look at realizing that these renewable systems aren't really in place yet to be able to completely replace oil and carbon forms of creating energy, not to mention the amount of just oil in general that has to go into producing, like as a raw material, producing the windmills.
The transition to this green energy requires more energy as we make it.
Exactly.
And we haven't even thought about that. And we're busy, you know, cutting back on the amount of fossil fuel energy we create and making and shaming it. I sure hope that we make it through this winter and without like lots of people getting like having problems and can't afford their heat. And it scares me, and I suspect that this problem is far from gone away, and that we're going to hear more about this in the coming years.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't agree more, Kevin. Yeah. Of course, all of your writings and your articles are available at posts.themacrotourist.com. I recommend, you know, at least checking it out. You have a very interesting perspective on which you look at all of these different subjects that we've talked about today. And of course your Twitter feed is entertaining and interesting as well, at Kevin Muir. Anything else, Kevin?
Well, that's it. If anybody wants to get a couple copies of the recent posts, just shoot me an email, kevin@themacrotourist.com. More than happy to fire those off to you. Thanks a lot. It's always great talking to you, Tom. And as much as I love your province, I hope your teams don't do as well this year.
Well, I appreciate your time, Kevin. And it's not my fault that Toronto sucks.
You got that. You're right.
Thanks for your time today, Kev.
Take care.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.